Good afternoon and welcome to the 49th Tortoise Shack Sunday special. My name is Tony Groves and probably know that at this stage I'm joined as always by my co-host and the problem who causes all the trouble in my world, Martin McMahon. Martin, how are you keeping?
Good morning, Tony. It's a gorgeous morning out there. Rain is coming down. Summer is here.
Yeah, there's reports of snow in Ashburn.
it's frosty.
Yeah, we are joined by two people familiar to listeners of the podcast. One regular contributor on the Sunday show, and one of my favorite people, Emma D'Souza. Emma, thank you so much for joining us again.
Lovely to be here this afternoon. Thank you.
Thank you. And we're joined by Sam McElwain. And listeners might remember Sam joined us to give us a socialist, loyalist perspective, unionist perspective a few weeks ago, and it got a great reaction, Sam. So thanks again to coming back and talking to us.
Not a problem. Always happy to engage.
Look, I am conscious we will want to get in there very quickly and talk about that. But there's also, Martin, we wanted to touch on briefly on COVID and reopening the situation there.
The numbers across Europe are just heading sky high. And you have to look at the UK and think, oh, my God, what are you doing? What are you doing? You know, this opening up on the 19th, you know, to call it freedom. I don't know. It's just madness. I think it's crazy. And 2/3 of the UK don't want that kind of reopening, which is really stark figure. So Boris Johnson is not on the same page as his people, and that's a dangerous place to be.
It's again, I've seen it though. It's Portugal is running high, Spain is running high. France yesterday said they were asking people not to go on their summer holidays to Spain. You know, all of these things are quite worrying, and we're hoping to go to Portugal next week to talk to João Pina and the Socialist Party there about the disaster that happened, because they did reopen at Christmas, then they closed, and then they reopened again. And this, Emma and Sam, this isn't a dig at you guys, but they reopened, if you recall, at school midterm in the UK. And a lot of British people arrived, and 2 weeks later, 10 days later, the Delta variant was spreading. So it's been a bit difficult. How do you guys feel about it, Emma, about the reopening situation? Throw your masks away or what's going on there?
Yeah, no, we will not be throwing our masks away. We actually just got our second shots here at the weekend. So we're very happy in our household. But of course, we'll be maintaining social distancing, wearing our masks, following the guidance for the foreseeable future, really, because it's clear from these numbers across Europe. I mean, if you look at the Netherlands, they went from like 1,000 cases a day to 10,000 in the space of 2 weeks after dropping restrictions. So we're not out of this yet. And I think this whole narrative around Freedom Day is really dangerous and quite a populist sort of language to be using when we're not there yet.
Sam, have you any feelings on it?
Yeah, I mean, the Freedom Day thing, it unsettles me too. Freedom from what exactly? I mean, if wearing a mask is the greatest sort of inconvenience that I've got to put up with at the minute, then that's fine. The only time I wear it is when I go into shops. So it doesn't really impact on me too much, and I'm happy to wear it. But yeah, the figures going up are quite disturbing. That's when the kids are off school at the moment. Come the end of August, if we are still having these figures and they go back to the super spreader factory, if you like, then we could be looking at another lockdown at Christmas. And you have to ask the question, is that what they're asking for? Is that what they want? By opening the doors now, letting everybody out, is there an ulterior motive here so they can have another lockdown come the winter? It's just, yeah, I don't know. I can't see how the rationale plays into it when you're looking at the data.
I'm going to play devil's advocate and go back to what they're actually saying in the terms of the British government. They're saying, if not now, when? They're saying, you know, the schools are closed. This is the time to do it. The weather's good. This is the time to do it. People are, you know, we're getting a decent summer. This is the time to do it. I'm also then going to contradict myself and say we had a conversation this week with Mike Ryan from the WHO, and he used the same phrase, if not now, when? And what he meant was the opposite. He said, when will we step up as a people and look after one another? If not now, when? When will we fix our health services? When will we have vaccine equality as opposed to inequality? And when will we address those issues? So it's a strange one, Emma, as someone who's really a human rights advocate all the time. You must see that as a, you know, the it's so obvious to the eye if you look beyond the sound bites that this is inequality. just going to pause the podcast for a moment to basically ask you for your support. There's a lot of podcasts coming out, a lot of content across the Tortoise Shack. Very proud this week of some of the stuff we've done. I want to big up a huge episode by Policed. It's 20 years of research and data that has gone into policing and racism, particularly looking at the travelling community and obviously in more recent decades of the new Irish population. I would really strongly suggest you check it out. Also, Rory had a phenomenal conversation, and I want to thank Gabrielle Colleran, Professor Gabrielle Colleran, friend of the pod, for making it work, making it happen with Dr. Mike Ryan of the WHO. Martin, that's just two out of about 14 podcasts so far this week.
Yeah, a lot of content coming out, Tony, and it's good stuff. This is, I mean, Dr. Ryan is brilliant. That's just brilliant. You have to go and listen to it. It is absolutely fabulous. And the man has just so much sense in him, Tony. It's unreal.
Yeah, I look, these podcasts, no ads, no sponsors. And if you don't want to have to listen to this, you can get the feed without these plugs. It's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. The reason we need it is to keep the show on the road. There's a lot coming out. We're trying to be that sort of alternative platform where we can have these voices, have those conversations like we had with Luke Ming Flanagan, like we had with Mick Wallace and with Claire Daly this week. I mean, you know, and we engage with our listeners. So come on board. There's lots of extra content. A lot of it, yeah, people say it's behind a paywall, but you know what? If it wasn't for those patrons, it doesn't happen.
Yeah, and I think we've interviewed more MEPs this week than any of the other radio stations have done all year, Tony. So I give us a pat on the back for that. So just remember, it's patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Thanks, and we'll let you get back to your pod now.
It's so obvious to the eye if you look beyond the sound bites that this is inequality.
Yeah, I mean, the vaccine rollout shows you just how stark inequality is across the world. So certainly I would be more in line with the WHO in that if not now, when, and that we do really have to step up in terms of, you know, addressing this in a global scale.
I just find it interesting that a virus has turned out to be more intelligent than the vast majority of politicians across the world. I mean, I just find that really interesting. There is a way to beat it. All they do is take it off patent, let everybody make their own, particularly in the global south, and get as many vaccinated as fast as possible. But you know, profit is the driving motive in all of this.
There's a public health official who's renowned in the audience, so I'm terrified of saying anything more than that. We'll maybe if they choose to comment that later on, that'd be good. But we can move on and talk about predominantly what's been going on in NI. I'm going to come to Sam first, if you don't mind. Sam, it's important to say, you know, we share a lot of politics. That's the truth. We both we look through the world through a left-leaning prism, and that's where we go. But what does something like the events of the last few nights and the bonfires, what does that actually mean to you? Because you spoke to me only a few weeks ago about your culture, about wanting to maintain your culture. What does that mean to you?
I remember building bonfires as a six-year-old boy in the Glencairn estate up the top of Shankill. To us, it was a community group, and the younger boys helped the older boys. We learned what to do. And you gathered in this tradition, and then come the 11th night, we had a street party. The local neighbours would bring out musical instruments or maybe a set of speakers and a record player, and they all chipped in for food. And it was a community-based party. It really was. I don't get the super bonfires. I think maybe they're too far up. I mean, it's just too much. And I certainly don't get the burning of effigies and flags. We never did that. We built the fire. We lit the fire. We had a good time. It's something that has evolved. I know there's comments this week from different people about it being a protest and showing signs of that. It's not how I would show my protest. I was in Tigers Bay yesterday at the bonfire and met a couple of local community reps. And they're quite aggrieved. And to be honest, There was a tourist that turned up and asked what the fuss was about. She couldn't see it. And I was like, yeah, if you want to pick a bonfire that's controversial, they could have picked a different bonfire than the Tigers Bay one, because really it wasn't that controversial. If they're going to bring into context then the interface area and the trouble that goes on, that happens all year round. That's not predominantly just for the 11th and 12th. That is continuous, and that's something that needs to be addressed. But the biggest thing to come out of this for me, especially from the Tigers Bay area, that's built on waste ground. Why is it waste ground? That needs to be developed. That is another working class area that has been left to rot and ruin. We should be looking at government departments and suggesting how we develop that ground for the community. Because if the ground's not there, the bonfire doesn't get built. It's as simple as that. There's a current program on the Shankill at the minute, a guy called Billy Drummond is leading, and they're looking at the waste ground that's still in the Shankill area. The regeneration that is required there is a community there that wants to feel included, that wants to feel as if people care. And we're crying out for resources, and it's just not there. Again, it is another working class area that's just been left to rot, and it shouldn't be that way.
Can I come in on just the working class aspect of this, and also of the unionist aspect of this? I'm conscious of, you know, you're on this podcast talking to us now, and it's always that kind of thing. You've burnt an Irish flag, so you should apologize on behalf of everybody in a working class community. So we're not going to play that game here. But you've already said that makes you uncomfortable. But I saw, Emma, you nodding your head saying when Samuel referred to the waste ground, and in effect what was a need for, again, it goes back to that issue of inequality and developing the areas is, you know, what's, you've been very vocal about it and some of this stuff, because it is incitement. Let's not sugar the pill. It's some of that is incitement, but we also need to be realistic about how you actually tackle that, Emma.
Yeah, I mean, there's lots to unpack here in terms of what we're seeing play out. And just to address, I suppose, some of the points made by Sam, yeah, there is a real socioeconomic issue here in terms of many of the most contentious bonfires are in predominantly working class areas that remain steeped in deprivation. And I think it's also important to highlight that some of these, you know, looming tars that are covered in Irish flags or political posters or sectarian signs do not represent all bonfires on the 11th night. And as Sam has said, you know, there are those that are much smaller and peaceful and pass without any issue and are a celebration of culture. But we do need to address the proliferation of anti-Irish sentiment that is stemming from these larger constructs and be clear that, you know, the burning of the national flag of your neighbours is actually an expression of hate. And when Sam was speaking there about being a child and building these bonfires, I mean, I was thinking about how that's a serious health risk to have children gathering wood, building bonfires. We saw a 16-year-old airlifted, to hospital at the weekend because they fell from the structure. And we saw also in Portadown the huge bonfire that collapsed and caused many to have to move back because it was such a risk in terms of to people's lives, including young children. Then there's also the risk to the buildings because of where the bonfires are being built, which results in, instead of these bonfires being moved, people that live in these homes having to have their homes boarded up and hosed down by the fire brigade. Many people are then forced to just leave their home during this period. So there's a whole rake of issues that need to be addressed in terms of social deprivation, socioeconomic factors, and also the fact that there are still paramilitary influences in some of these areas that are feeding in to that anti-Irish sentiment.
Can I ask about the Southern political view on this? We had, when we all remember the Bobby Storey funeral, but there was huge reaction from Southern politicians. I suppose they made hay with it is the best phrase I could use. But when it comes to bonfires, burning effigies, burning flags, we hear absolutely nothing from Southern politicians. Does that give you a sense that they only use the North as leverage to kick out at Sinn Féin? That's what the North exists for.
There certainly is an element of that in the discourse that we hear and the choice of when a politician across the border will choose to make their views on the North clear. And it has been a point of much frustration for myself. And certainly I often see things too from my husband's perspective, because as an American citizen, he sees what happens here through a whole different prism in terms of like it being totally abnormal. And is always fascinated by the fact that when it comes to the South, there's very little reporting. Politicians do not take a stand or say anything about it. And I mean, we saw here a 45-foot tricolour being burned, or another bonfire where they actually went to the effort of painting the pallets into the distinctive colours of the Irish flag So the entire structure would be an altar of the Irish nation to be turned into ashes. You know, this should be spoken about by politicians across the border.
Sam, do you find it strange that Irish politicians only ever talk about Northern Ireland as leverage for their own political ambitions down here?
That they don't actually across the board in most governments. Northern Ireland only ever comes up whenever there's leverage or point scoring or some sort of political capital to gain from it. I mean, most of the other times of the year we're left alone. Unless they have something to benefit from, we're forgotten about. And I think the skeptic in me would say that the best way to keep Northern Ireland is on a constant knife edge, because they can keep coming back and milking this cow for years to come. That goes across every government, that whether it be European in Brussels, whether it be in the South, whether it be in Westminster. We are a political football, and we are here to be used to a large extent to score points. So while in the Dáil, they'll beat Sinn Féin over the head with the North, and Westminster will do the same with the Unionists, and then go to the European. It's used as a bargaining chip. As far as the tricolour goes, again, I don't particularly believe in burning the tricolour, but people within the community will argue that these flags are placed over the coffins of IRA men. So it becomes, it's not about burning the flag of the company next to us. It's probably a two-finger salute to those who put the flag over people who have killed and bombed people in their own community. It's just another way, as I said, striking out.
I wonder how it would be perceived, particularly by the loyalist community up north, if we did the same down here. I wonder how it would be perceived. I wonder, would we be so forgiven?
It wouldn't be acceptable, Martin.
It wouldn't be.
The Union flag would be burnt on some bonfires around in tournament time in the nationalist community. But this is not about whataboutery. They do.
You've
got to take a step back, and you got to be your own moral compass in this. And that's why I don't feel that we should be. The bonfires are there for a different reason. It's not about looking across the wall as such and being aggressive
Sam, tell us what it is about for you.
Well, yeah. As I said, for me, it was always a community thing to mark this time of year. Whenever our cultural events come to a sort of a peak with the marches on the 12th, it was always the sort of the hors d'oeuvre to the main event, if you want. And as I said before, it was a community event for us. I mean, so before I got educated, before I understood the significance of bonfires and guiding William to the Boyne and all the rest of the other stuff, it was a day. I don't like comparing it to like a Guy Fawkes or anything like that, but it was a community event. Where we were in Glencairn, we didn't know who could see the fire and who couldn't see the fire. We didn't care. It was for us. It wasn't for anybody outside of our circle. It wasn't to intimidate, to incite, to cause offence. It was for us to have something to gather around, something to focus on and to give us. Because remember, those times we had nothing. We were very poor. And this was a time where you sort of splashed out. You could afford to go and buy a few beers if you were the dad of the family, or you could have a street party and there would be things like cocktail sausages or whatever brought out. It was a time to the party that wasn't a wedding, that wasn't Christmas. It was just something for us to do as a community. And we celebrated it.
I think just to maybe come in and put my point, my view on that, I think we really have to see this through a human rights perspective, you know, and the fact that in the Good Friday Agreement includes that everyone and all communities in Northern Ireland have the right to live a life in peace and free from sectarian harassment. There is absolutely a legitimate cultural expression in the shape of bonfires, but not when they're used to proliferate hate towards any one community. And if this was bonfires targeting Jewish communities or Muslim communities, they would be widely condemned. So I don't think there is any excuse that is viable to justify the use of Irish flags on these bonfires. You know, there's just no excuse justifiable for it.
Emma, can I just on that? I want to make one point, and I think I totally support what you've said, but I also pointed to the difficulty, and I point listeners to go back and listen to the recent conversation with Dr. Topping that Vicky had on police in terms of policing in the PSNI's job, and how difficult it is to say, you know, when they will over police, under police, and where they will withdraw when, you know, when actual things are being done that are contrary to the law. But they say, well, this, if we go a step further, then it may cause a inflagration, you know, it might inflame things that we necessarily wouldn't. And it goes back to almost Martin's point around, you know, half of the problems that kicked off were because the PSNI were seen to not have been hard enough on what happened around Bobby Storey's funeral, and the, you know, the calls for action on that. So I just want to put everything in that context. It is, I'd hate to be the people having to make that call, Emma. I suppose it's. I agree with you. There's no excuse for burning another nation's flag. Look, we're going to talk about football later, and the English football team spent few months booing their own players. They won't be booing them tonight, I can tell you. You know, we see how these things happen, but unfortunately, when I see a 45-foot Irish tricolour going up in flames, yeah, it doesn't send a good message. Sorry, Emma, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I think you're making a really good point around the PSNI, and it is a really difficult place to police in terms of, you know, managing community relations. But I think over the past 2 weeks in the run-up to the 12th, there have been some decisions that will have frustrated those from the nationalist community, and also those who are from neither, who are just wanting to live in a shared society free from any of the sectarianism of the past, and preferably free from flags adorning every single lamppost in the area. And we've ticked, for example, the integrated school in South Belfast, where a British flag was placed at the entrance into the integrated school. The school and the parents and the neighbourhood, which is shared, all requested that this flag be removed. And the PSNI said that they would not intervene because then more flags would just go up. When it comes to the interface in North Belfast, the Adam Street bonfire, I think that, you know, the community on the other side from New Lodge have said that they really feel like they're being held siege, you know, with this constant tension between the two sides over this bonfire. The PSNI said that they would not intervene because there was evidence that perhaps the UDA had firearms and bombs going into the bonfire site. So because this side was threatening violence, the PSNI chose not to intervene. And if you were to apply that to another city, Los Angeles, Dublin, London, where there was a threat of violence and the police deciding not to intervene, and where there are firearms which are illegal and they choose not to intervene, that would raise serious questions.
Sam, can I ask about, and you were saying about the wasteland that's there, would it be better to have something like, first of all, housing, because I mean, housing is a huge issue, both north and south, but housing there, but also some sort of cultural center, you know, culture done properly, where people can be invited in to read the culture, to look at the culture, to understand the culture. Would that be a better option than bonfires?
I mean, you could probably sit here and list 20 different options. I mean, Tigers Bay is famous for producing one of our most famous boxers. The boxing club could be rebuilt there. There's various scenarios where that ground could be better used. Now, I'm not saying that next year if they built it, that there wouldn't be a bonfire, but it wouldn't be there. It could be further in the state or on a different sort of piece of land somewhere else. But I mean, it would negate that interface area being that close to the fire. Going back to what Emma's saying about the police in Northern Ireland, it is. I mean, it's a hateful job that I wouldn't fancy myself. But if we're looking at threats of violence, I mean, people will quote the Bobby Storey funeral as an example of where, again, the police had to turn a blind eye in their eyes, that if they had have tried to police it more strictly, they would have caused violence or outbreaks of protests. So it is a balancing act for the PSNI. They don't always get it right. They don't always get it wrong either. But it's just one job I wouldn't like to do. But I can understand what Emma's saying. But also, it's one of those things, what's the alternative for these people? Let's talk to people. And I mean, in the Woodfield area of the Shangle, they laid a torch tonight. They've moved away from the bonfire, and they've replaced it with a symbolic torch. There's other ways to engage. There's other ways to let people celebrate their culture, but they're not going to do that if they feel that they're being attacked first. And talk to them, let them come round, let them discuss what they want to do, rather than telling them what they want to do, because forcing people into things will never bring a solution.
Yeah, actually, I think just to highlight too that there are a number of sites across Northern Ireland that have adopted the environmentally clean beacons, where it was a design done, I think, by Groundwork NI, where they are reusable structures that are done on a bed of sand to protect the ground underneath, and that they have willow wood in them, so it's environmentally clean. And I think like that's pretty, you know, that goes back to the historical significance in terms of what's being celebrated on the 11th night bonfires. And it is a safe and environmentally friendly way to celebrate culture. So I think if there were more instances of that, you know, we can make progress in this area.
I am conscious of time. We do need to discuss a couple of other things, but I am really glad that we've had this this boat. But and I'm putting people on opposite sides. It's not. It's actually it's a conversation. It's a dialogue. It's about reaching some sort of understanding. And I think it's really important that we continue to do that. So on that, Sam, I really thank you for sharing that. Please stick around. If anybody's any comments, Emma, please stick around. I am going to move us on, Martin, just if that's okay, because I want to talk about our own
mini drama, we'll call it.
Yeah, we had our own by-election, and it was interesting, and yet it was almost predictable insofar as what's happened. It's the outpouring now. This is some of the predictable things you see today. We're already hearing calls for Micheál Martin has to resign, and all of this stuff has to happen now. So it's interesting where it's going, Martin. What's your take?
I think it became predictable about 2 weeks out. I think when people realized that Jogan wasn't the best candidate, the best foot forward for Fine Gael. I think at that stage that the writing was on the wall.
You need to learn to say Geoghegan, first of all.
Geoghegan. But anyway, I think, look, Ivana deserved the win for that constituency. She was the perfect candidate in the perfect place at the perfect time. Do I think it could be replicated across the country? Certainly not. Certainly not. That's not going to be replicated across the country. What it does show mostly is that government parties are down 25 points on support since the general election. Now, that's huge. That's massive.
I just, before we bring Simon McGarr is here. He's written a really fascinating gist, as Simon tends to do on this. But before he joins, I just want to go through some of the headline stuff that happened. If you want to look at it, I think the Greens in general election 2020 had 22%. They finished on 8% in the by-election. Sinn Féin just held ground at 16% and 16%. Fine Gael came in slightly, about 1% lower than they did in the general election. Probably my bias is showing, they were polling higher. They were polling at 30 to 33%. So, you know, it's a bad day for them. It was their seat. And then Fianna Fáil have had an absolute disaster at, you know, not even, like, I think Deirdre Conroy, I feel sorry for her that you see the stories of her no one standing beside her as she was eliminated from the count. But I don't even think she's got enough votes to actually get her deposit back. Simon, can I go to you and ask you what you made of it? Maybe we can point some listeners in direction of your piece on it.
I suppose the thing that was most striking was that every party went out, and the different parties had different aims from this election. One would think that the aim would always be get your candidate elected. I'm not sure that actually was Fianna Fáil's aim on this occasion, given that they had a director of elections who had only just managed to hold on to his seat by the skin of his teeth, and he's holding the one Fianna Fáil seat in this constituency. It was a little fanciful to think that by making him director of elections, he would do his all to create a rival in his own constituency to share those very few votes. So I think there was probably a built-in conflict of interest there, and perhaps that might be one of the reasons Fianna Fáil didn't have their best day out. There might be other reasons as well. Nonetheless, I think the more interesting things were a sort of three-party story in the election. There was Fine Gael's story, there was Labour's story, And really, that was a Vanna Batchik story. And there was Sinn Féin's story. And of all of them, the one that was most revealing from a national point of view, if we don't happen to live in Dublin Bay South, is the Fine Gael story. Because what Fine Gael did was they rolled out their national electoral strategy into a single-seat constituent, a single-seat election. The result is that they ran an election campaign against one of the other major parties in that constituency. That was what they wanted to do. They wanted to run against Sinn Féin.
They identified themselves as we are not Sinn Féin.
And the idea was, if you create a dichotomy where it's Sinn Féin or Fine Gael in Dublin Bay South, well, there'll be more Fine Gael voters than there are Sinn Féin voters, and you win out. The problem is that Sinn Féin had, as you say, approximately 27% vote on the last occasion. And in order to get to the quota, they had to get somewhere over the 50% plus one, because it was a one-seat constituency. That meant that they had to take transfers from other parties as they were eliminated. And if you run against one of the other parties, you've built in an impossibility, because that party's supporters will naturally transfer more to your opponents than they will to you. So the result is that if you run against Sinn Féin in a one-seat constituency, and there's any other candidate who is likely to gather the transfers, and it was very clear from the start Vanna Batchik was that candidate, the result is that you've guaranteed that you're running two against one in terms of party support. So Fine Gael hadn't learned anything from their general election performance, because in the general election, you may recall, they only wanted to talk about Brexit. Now, nobody else wanted to talk about Brexit, but every day they came out and they had a special discussion about Brexit, and that was the answer to all the questions. It was like they were running the campaign they'd like to have, and it didn't occur to them that perhaps other people might want to talk about things like housing and, I don't know, health and things like that, things that matter to them. From Fine Gael's point of view, a campaign is like a squash match. You keep knocking your Fine Gael talking points against the uncaring wall of the electorate, and whether they bounce back or not doesn't really matter. So that's how they approach it, and that seems to be how they continue to approach it. They've demonstrated they've learned nothing. They switched Brexit for Sinn Féin. I mean, the chances of Sinn Féin taking a one seat electoral victory in Dublin Bay South was akin to that of a Dalek invasion of Earth, and it made just as much sense to run against Sinn Féin as it would to run against a Dalek invasion. So in terms of credibility, it was absurd. I mean, and this doesn't get to the candidate at all. These are just structural problems with the way Fine Gael approached the election.
I need to push in on this, because Simon, if he were with his virtual background, he'd probably have a Dalek in the background. So we'd probably be looking at it now. I am interested, Sam and Emma. I'm sure you probably have no interest in our politics in terms of some of these issues, but you must have watched as, you know, Simon's point around people pushing Sinn Féin versus Fine Gael, then Fine Gael versus Brexit. And now we hear all the stuff around the protocol. Sam, you know, there's been an extension in the protocol for a few months that we can continue to bring sausages in or whatever it is. We very much had a government down here last February 2020 saying that the biggest success they had was making sure that the protocol was actually enshrined. How has that kind of narrative now, where does it stand in the people who you talk to and are in your community?
The extension is just another can-kicking exercise. All we're doing is delaying the inevitable here. And I think what they're trying to do is get over this period that they term the marching season and try and keep as much of it in the box as they possibly can in case it erupts. But nothing's going to be achieved from this until we actually sit down and work out what it is. The protocol, I don't think the protocol is going to go away anywhere. But and there are those that are calling that it must be scrapped. I would say it needs to be renegotiated. It needs to be restructured. We need to look at it. If we can't get rid of it, then we need to make it more beneficial for the people of Northern Ireland, all of them. And we need to look at how we do that, because at the minute, it's being decided by governments outside of our own jurisdiction. And all they're doing afterwards is coming to us to get our view on what they've done.
Was Brexit not a decision by a government outside your jurisdiction, really and truly? I mean, the majority of people up north voted against Brexit and their wishes aren't being respected.
Yes, but that was taken as a decision across the entire UK. We can nitpick. You could say that maybe John Finucane shouldn't have won the last election as MP because a certain area didn't vote for him. It was taken. There's a set of rules, and the rules are applied at the time. The thing about the Northern Ireland Protocol was it was a discussion taken above our heads. We were locked out of the room, and it's not the first time that has happened. If they had engaged better, and I mean with all sections of the community and not just the DUP at the time that they used for votes, this could have been a lot better. I see somebody's commented there, William of Orange was a Dutchman. I'm not too sure what Andrew's asking, but he was, yes. and the protocol, and the worst thing about the protocol is nobody fully understands it. That is it. It is a piece of paper that people are taking bits out of to either support their argument or to support their disagreement with. It is convoluted. It is roundabout. It deals with things. I'm going to Scotland to visit my in-laws, and I can't take my dogs because it's going to cost me over £200 for rabies shots to bring them back in the Northern Ireland. I can take them to Scotland, but I'll need to leave them there unless I have a pet passport and a rabies shot for them. I mean, that is ridiculous. Absolutely ridiculous. It's a family pet. It's not as if I'm bringing 100-headed cattle in to slaughter them for steaks against the Europeans.
I have to swoop in there, Sam, because do you know you actually require a pet passport to cross the border into Donegal as well?
Yeah. And who's going to know? If you walk a pet dog in some of the fields in South Armagh, you cross the border by six times, you know, and there's nobody there to protect it. But the thing about going to Scotland is that we do have to pass through security at a port. And it's just... It's crazy that somebody thought that this was required.
I put in for a second and just ask you both, the by-election that we just had in Dublin Bay South, what didn't figure at all in the by-election was Northern Ireland. It never raised, no discussion was ever held. Does that show kind of the seriousness of Irish politicians in preparing for the future of Northern Ireland? And the future is going to be different to the way it is now.
I think you make an interesting point that it wasn't raised, you know, like especially since we had the over Edgar speaking recently about how he believes a United Ireland is in sight, but yet this was not a subject that was ever discussed in the run up to the election. Before I actually do a little bit on the by-election, because of course I am following it really closely, I do have a little bit of an interest in the politics across the border. I think I just want to highlight around this discourse on the Northern Ireland Protocol that I have a really hard time squaring the issue of consent with the Northern Ireland Protocol. When you think about the fact that if every single voter in Northern Ireland voted against Brexit, it would have happened anyway without the consent of the people here. So I really have a hard time squaring this circle on consent when we're talking about Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol. But in terms of the election in the South, I think that, look, this was Ivana's victory. We're not Sinn Féin argument is one that me and Sam will both be very familiar with across the border. I don't think that Ivana's victory really says anything for Labour, because I think it was just because she was the right candidate for the right area. And I think that Micheál Martin most certainly would already be considered to be taken out of his position of leadership when he steps down as Taoiseach. But this may actually speed up that process in terms of the internal chaos, if you like, within the party. And we'll see if Jim O'Callaghan is going to step forward and try to take those reins before the change in Taoiseach next year.
He definitely stayed. Like, I mean, there's an ongoing joke. Go ahead.
That seems to be the most probably long-term significance of the consequences of the election. Is actually Jim O'Callaghan's prospects as taking over as leader. From his point of view, for him, I mean, if we presume that Kate O'Connell is actually going to run on the next election, Fine Gael will have to swallow their pride and come back to her. If we presume that she then is elected, if we also presume, and I think this is a safe bet, that once they have elected Ivana Bagic, they're not going to turn their back on her immediately. The result is that Jim O'Callaghan is the person who will be left standing when the music stops with no seat. So the consequences of this election for him have turned out to be the most significant of any of the of anybody, and he wasn't even a candidate, because from the point of view of his party, they either elect him in the hope that being a party leader is sufficient to bump him up in the eyes of his constituency, or they decide that it's too dangerous to elect a person who's a marginal seat holder, because the result might be that they might not get elected. And immediately, if your party leader isn't elected, then the end is not.
So, Simon, game. Sorry, can I make a point that the game has moved to one part in Fine Gael, Fianna Fáil, that there's already Dara O'Brien has positioned himself to a run against Jim O'Callaghan, and that's already happening. We've seen that now in so many times. Sam, did you want to come in?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting listening to you guys talking about the politics in the South. I think what you're actually getting a taste of at the minute is the politics of the North, where the late David Irvine said we vote for what we don't want, as opposed to what we do. So the discussion here at the minute is all around Sinn Féin. It's all around everything except for the stuff that you guys need to be sort of focused on. And the same up here, I mean, housing, health, mental health, the things that we should be focusing on every time an election comes around, gets pushed to the side, and out comes a one-dimensional, one issue, and bandwagon that everybody jumps on. So I would love for the boys up here to actually get on board and start thinking about what they want to vote for. But it's just interesting to watch you guys in the South actually get a small taste of it for a change, and God help us if it continues.
I'd just like to point out that both Leo Varadkar is also a marginal seat. It's a very marginal seat for him, and actually runs the risk of not getting elected next time out as well.
I don't know. Like, listen, let's not go there. I think actually he's the most popular leader in the South, Martin. So you can smile.
I always think that demographic is high for that at all. Yeah, no, it's not. It's not.
Being the best of a bad bunch doesn't make you the best, you know.
It's why I'm
the most favorite host of the Echo Chamber podcast.
It's also kind of a meaningless metric. It doesn't translate into votes. You know, being the most popular leader didn't translate into votes in this election. It just didn't. So I always find that a very meaningless metric. I mean, you can have 4% of the vote like Labour does and still have 30%
The only interesting thing about Fine Gael at the moment is that there are lots of rumours circulating that people who have been in government for over a decade will not run in the next election because they don't want to go into opposition for 4 years. That is their feeling. That's the only interesting thing about them.
I think you'll see that by spades in Fianna Fáil as well. I think you'll see that a lot of people will jump before the next election.
Martin, you wanted to mention what's coming up on Bogus Self-Employment next week.
Yeah, I've been doing a bit of work on Bogus Self-Employment in the background. It's coming up next week. There'll be some interesting answers due next week, so keep an eye on that ball. It's going to get very interesting very quickly.
We have the new Lord Mayor of Dublin tomorrow, Alison Gilliland, joining us, and allegedly again the Minister for Housing joining us on Thursday as well, and we're also going back to Gaza to speak to Hannah because she had problems today with her she was pulled to an assignment, so we couldn't do that then. I am conscious of time. Simon, if you were to take one takeaway from the events in Irish politics, what would be your lesson or the thing that we haven't learned from the Dublin Bay South by election?
We've lost Simon.
Yeah, it's all right. Look, we will.
Oh, here he is.
Here I am. Am I?
Yes, yep. We got you, Simon.
Very good. I think the main thing to take away from it is that Fine Gael are still where they were at the last general election. They haven't moved on.
Simon, we've lost you there on the feed, so we'll have to leave it there. There he's gone, Tony.
Yeah.
Tony, what do you think? What is it that you think that learnings you have done. I hate that word, but learnings you have taken from it.
Simple thing was, it was the Labour picked the right candidate for the right location, and it's Ivana. It's Ivana's day. She's been around a long time. You can, you know, we had the conversation on the podcast about her views on certain aspects that we disagree with, but obviously enough of the electorate agreed with her. So
yeah, I think it shows that candidate selection in any constituency is the most vital thing. You have to pick the right candidate for that constituency, and parachuting people in who aren't part of the constituency is never really a successful thing to do.
I don't know. Emma and Sam, just before we wrap, guys, I'm wondering if there's any, you know, I keep going back to this phrase, and I know, Sam, you don't like it. We talk about the shared island. We talk about what we're going to do. We look at some events like the 12th and how we build up to it and all. Dialogues like even this conversation today, we need to have more of these dialogues that impact on people in the South all the time. They need to be more cognizant of it and not just in terms of bonfires. How do we, Emma, you think about these things a lot. How do we do this?
Yeah, I mean, it's already, there is a lot of cross-border civic engagement that already happens. And it is something that I try to highlight as best I can, that there is this disconnect that is prevalent in mainstream society between the North and the South. And I'll give you an example, because I'm currently convening an all Ident Women's Forum in my day job at the National Women's Council. And for that, I'm bringing in a selection of individuals and groups in the North and in the South to bring them together to talk about cross-border cooperation and dialogue and how to ensure that women's voices in peace building are really being heard. And when I was looking at the organizations in the South, you know, very few were actually doing peace building programs or striving for all island approaches to areas of cooperation and dialogue, whereas nearly all in the North have some form of cross-community, cross-border or cooperation and peace building structures already in place. So that highlights that there is a disconnect in terms of how in a civic space we're addressing issues around this island and in the North. So in that regard, I think there's lots of room to grow, and I will continue as best I can to try and push that dialogue as far as I can go with it.
Sam, same sort of vibe to you now. What do you think in terms of, you know, I mean, it's a funny old world where in the South we kind of go quiet around this. What do you think?
I mean, my mother was a member of the Women's Orange Institution for years, and one of our best parades every year was one at Ross Nyler. And she always expressed how welcoming it was, the fact that maybe two to four guards were on duty for the whole event. It can be facilitated. I mean, that's the thing. But there has to be a desire on both sides to facilitate the other side, no matter which way this goes. And I think that's where we have the issue. There is too much entrenchment. And to give is to concede sometimes. We need to move past that mindset. It's not always about conceding to the enemy if you want to be sort of aggressive about it. But I don't think we foster the right atmosphere, the right scenario for people to discuss these things. We build these up into confrontational issues like the Tigers Bay. And then we ask the communities to discuss it. By that point, we've got them riled up, and that neither are going to have a coherent conversation. We need to do this, if you want to look at it, off-season. We need to do this with calm heads, and we need to approach it with a bit of honesty. And you talked today about having a dialogue between ourselves here. Yeah, we can understand each other. It doesn't mean we have to concede anything to each other. It doesn't mean we agree on everything, but we understand each other better. And I think that's where we need to be, an understanding of each other's cultures and each other's perspectives, and maybe a bit of empathy. Wouldn't go missing some of these cases.
Sam,
I think we're sadly missing.
Sam, Emma, Tony, and also to Simon, thank you very much for coming on and having this conversation today. It's enlightening to have people on and having this conversation. Really enjoyed it. Look, just what remind everybody that, you know, we don't survive on air here on the Tour de Chec. We need your dollars to keep this show on the road. So patreon.com/Tour de Chec. Stick your hand in your pocket and let's keep these really interesting conversations going. Thank you.